Good afternoon. We've covered three cities in a very large sample of young MSM. We've covered now a nationwide sample of gay men, specifically gay and bisexual men. I'm going to shift our focus to transgender women, a group that is less studied in this area. I have no relationships to disclose. I will disclose that I'm not going to show any video of butts. And Brian has not stolen most of my talk, so no offense, but I'm good with that. So when we look at HIV among transgender women, the meta-analyses that have been done, one particularly in 2008 that gets cited quite a bit, shows a very high prevalence of HIV among transgender women. And about 28% when you test trans women, and about 12% when you base it on self-report exclusively. And African-American trans women end up in these studies having the highest prevalence, over half, compared to other racial and ethnic groups. Again, this is when you look at sort of all of the studies that have been published. 29 in 2008 still wasn't very many studies. Ironically, not that many more have been published since 2008. It's still a population that is definitely understudied. So when we focus on New York City specifically, which is where we're doing our work, so it's relevant here, there was a study in 2009 published that was a study of over 500 trans women in New York who were surveyed. And they really saw the disproportional affecting of this through women of color, with almost half of the women who tested positive for HIV were Latina, and 48% who tested positive were African American. So only about 2% of the women who tested positive were white. So it's definitely affecting trans women of color in a way that is greater. When we look at New York City data from 2009 to 2013, there were 212 new diagnoses among transgender persons. Almost all of them were among trans women specifically. 93% were among Black or Latina trans women, and 66% were among young trans women, ages 13 to 29. When we switch from HIV, which we don't even really know that much about with this population, to STIs, we know even less. About 21% will report STIs on average. This is based on that 2008 meta-analysis. Fewer trans women of color self-reported having other STIs, however. In New York City, the same NetBrock study found a rate of syphilis of 21.6% for Black trans women, 14% for Latina versus 1% for white. And with hepatitis B and C, you saw similar differentials with regard to race and ethnicity. Really scarce data on gonorrhea and chlamydia, and almost nothing is known about screening for these STIs that is non-urethral, so for the rectal testing that we're going to talk about. And when it comes to sort of broader HIV-STI prevention among trans women, we also see some major deficits in the work that's being done. Only a few interventions have even included trans women, and there are no evidence-based interventions in the CDC compendium of interventions that were developed specifically for trans women. Some of the EBIs out there included small numbers of trans women as part of a larger study, but nothing has been developed specifically for this population. We actually designed the first intervention that was specifically targeting trans women several years ago as part of a CDC-funded project, but it was just a pilot study to look at the feasibility and cultural acceptability of the intervention. It did show some preliminary outcomes that led us to apply for an NIH-funded RCT to formally evaluate it, and we've included STI testing as a component of that. So that's the study that I'm going to talk about. It's called TTOC. It's a multi-component intervention to reduce sexual risk and substance use among transgender women in New York City who use substances. As Christian showed, it's a big team at CHEST who is responsible for this kind of work, as well as, importantly, some of our community partners, Asa Raddix from Callan Lord and Carrie Davis from the Center in New York, who work very closely with us on this study. To give you an overview, we started with a phase one where we did some refinement of the intervention from the original pilot work. We took a lot of input from transgender women who were hired as peer health navigators to work on the project, as well as our community partners. We then did a pilot of the refined intervention, and then we launched the RCT, and we are comparing it to a waitlist control to look at if it's effective in reducing substance risk, sexual risk and substance use, as well as trying to increase coping skills and risk buffering skills. So that's the goal of the intervention. We are partway through the RCT. We're shooting for 240 women. Recruitment has been a challenge for us. We're used to doing very active field-based recruitment with the gay and bisexual men that we work with. It's much more difficult to do that with trans women. It's the sensitive nature of inquiring if somebody is trans out in a public space. There are issues with that. So we've really focused on trying to build the visibility of the project in the community, being very active at community events that are run by and target trans women, meetings in the community, and really sort of try to build a sense of trust. Word of mouth has been particularly critical. Once women know that this is a safe place to come and talk about these issues, they're much more likely to call for screening and potential enrollment. But it's a barrier because there's just a lot of mistrust about research in general, and then when you start to add a medical component, in our case STI testing, that mistrust increases even more. So we've really done a lot of passive recruitment, really relying on community organizations in part to refer women into this study. To be eligible, you have to be 18 or older, identify as a transgender woman or woman of trans experience, report some form of penetrative sex in the past 60 days, report the use of illicit drugs in the past 60 days, live in the New York City area. We are going to report data on the 101 trans women that are enrolled at this point. So participants will complete a baseline, and then they're randomized to either the TTOC intervention, which involves 3 one-on-one sessions in 4 groups, all led by peer health navigators, or the waitlist control condition. And we do follow-ups every 4 months, and then the waitlist participants can start participating in the intervention after the 8-month assessment. It's a very comprehensive assessment battery. This is such an understudied population that we feel compelled to get as much data as we possibly can, especially once they've sort of developed that sense of trust with us. So we do a fairly detailed CASI looking at factors related to minority stress, syndemics, resilience, mechanisms of change, those sorts of things. And then we do a timeline follow-back interview to get day-level sexual and drug use behavior with the women. Then we do biological testing for HIV, syphilis, and both urethral and rectal gonorrhea and chlamydia. And the testing is being done by our partners at Callen Lord. And we've already talked about the nucleic acid amplification tests. So Brian did steal some of them. So these are the demographic characteristics of the 101 women that are enrolled thus far. The mean age is about 33, with a range from 18 to 70. It's about 25% in each of those age groups that are represented up there. It's 32% Black, 40% Latina, and 12% white, with 17% being multiracial or identifying as an other group. It is 44% HIV positive, and 52% of them are partnered. This is how they identify both their gender and their sexual identity. So the majority of them identify as just a female woman, and 24% specifically identify as a transgender woman, with smaller numbers identifying as either confused or still identifying their gender as male. With regard to their sexual identity, the majority, 60%, identify as straight, with 10% identifying as queer, 14% as bisexual, and 16% as lesbian. So a fair amount of diversity with regard to the sexual identity. The drug use, again, this is a drug-using sample, so it's a little different in that you have to have been reporting some drug use to be enrolled. But the number of drug use days in the past 60 prior to baseline, the mean is 35. Most of them are reporting marijuana use. That's the drug of choice. You sometimes just have to be stoned to live in New York City. 48%, though, do report using other drugs, and this is the breakdown of those. It's predominantly cocaine. Very little of the sort of club drugs, the ketamine, GHB. We might see higher rates in that if this was a gay sample, but the trans women are not focused on those drugs in the same way that we see in our other studies. Sexual behavior, looking at the 60 days prior to baseline, again, all the women had to be sexually active to be enrolled, and so some of these numbers are, the means are sort of a little problematic because we did have some outliers with huge numbers of partners and acts, so the median may be sort of a better way to look at that. So a median of 4 sex partners, a median of 15 penetrative acts in the last 60 days, and 4 condomless penetrative acts. 16% of the women reported no condomless anal sex, or no condomless penetrative sex, in the 60 days prior to baseline. So what do we get with the diagnoses? So about 28% of the sample tested positive for STIs. 2% tested positive for 2 or more. 34% were already known to be HIV positive. Almost 22% tested positive for syphilis, and of those, 4.3% had an untreated infection. Again, 37.8% of those who tested positive for syphilis were positive, HIV positive. And 7% tested positive for rectal, while only 2% tested positive for urethral. So we're seeing a very similar pattern to the other two presentations, that where you're really getting the sort of biggest hits for new diagnoses of STIs is through rectal sites rather than urethral. Our study, we found that chlamydia was more common than gonorrhea, 6% versus 3%. We didn't have any positive chlamydia urethral results. When we sort of break this down by the ethnic and racial compositions, we have small sample sizes in some groups, particularly the white women, so it's a challenge to get statistical significance here, but we do see a significant result for syphilis, specifically with the women of color being more likely to have reported that, black women and multiracial women. For untreated syphilis, it's marginally significant, but even though it's not statistically significant, I think it's important to look at the NE-STI rates, and it's really high among women who identify as black and multiracial or other women. A lot of the multiracial women identify as black and Latina, or black and white, or some sort of combination. It's remarkable that the rates are so much higher there than particularly for the white women. And then for any rectal STI, that's where we see higher numbers with the white women. And so we're hoping to enroll more white women into the sample so that we can get the sample size higher to be able to do some better statistical comparisons there to see what's going on. It's also possible that this is just a weird artifact of the few white women that we have enrolling in the study. We just don't know at this point. When we do comparisons by HIV status, we definitely get a significant result in terms of syphilis, with the positive women being more likely to be diagnosed as having syphilis. But again, if you sort of look at any STIs, although it's not statistically significant at this point, we are seeing higher rates among the positive women. So 1 in 4 of our trans women are testing positive for STIs in this study, and the prevalence of syphilis was similar to national and local estimates, but with the trans women of color particularly having a higher prevalence. The rectal testing is showing that additional infections can be detected, and as has been mentioned by both of the previous presenters, it really does sort of lead one to think about how important it is to do screening at rectal sites for STIs. No statistically significant associations of STI with potential behavior correlates, including drug use. Now again, we're dealing with, you know, a slightly skewed sample in that they all have to report drug use to be enrolled, but even in terms of level of drug use or number of days of drug use, we're not seeing a significance there. Definitely some limitations. This is still a small, convenient sample of women who are willing to be screened and enroll in an intervention trial. The enrollment's ongoing, and hopefully with the rates that we're seeing, we're going to have enough power to better understand some of these differences so that we can hopefully tailor prevention messages accordingly. There's a certain degree of sample bias, which is really a challenge working with transgender samples in the absence of any sort of local or national surveillance data. We don't know to what degree our sample is representative of the broader population of trans women, even in the New York City area. And this right now is, I'm presenting cross-sectional data. We're doing this longitudinally, so hopefully over time we'll get more power to look at changes in what's happening with both diagnoses and incidence. So in conclusion, we just need to learn more about transgender women with regard to particularly STIs, but even HIV. There's an increased need for surveillance data. The way that CDC monitors this is not very trans-inclusive currently, so hopefully that's going to change. And there are just inadequate resources focused on this population. There are now, I think, 3 or 4 NIH-funded intervention trials focused on trans women. When you compare that to how many trials are focused on MSM. It's definitely a group that is in need of behavioral intervention research, and particularly research that is culturally sensitive and addresses the concerns of transgender women, and really doing the formative research necessary to make sure that what you're developing is going to be appropriate is a critical piece. I want to acknowledge all of these folks who played an important role in this, and thank you.
So, one follow-up question for Jeff is, do you have any information on, I mean, with 60% of your trans women in the study identifying as a straight or heterosexual, do you have any information on the characteristics of sexual partners?
Yeah, we do. We haven't gotten into that data yet, but we do have, particularly through the timeline follow-back, right. We collect partner-level characteristics for all the sexual behaviors, so we will be able to look at that.
So I think this kind of, that's going to be important in terms of the STI prevalence and which STIs will be in the sexual networks of those partners. And in our experience, you know, many of those women who identify as straight very often have heterosexual partners, and based on the race, there may be networks for certain diseases may be more prevalent than others. So this concludes our presentation part. So I'm going to make some reflections. I mean, I think one thing that comes here, they say, I mean, that the rates of STDs, men and cis men and transgender women are really high. And as Brian said at the beginning, one of the issues is that sexually transmitted infections in MSM has really never been taken seriously. STDs, from the CDC perspective, has always been seen in the extent that they are, they can cause, you know, disease to the female genital tract. And from the HIV perspective, sexually transmitted infections have always been seen as markers of high-risk behavior. And we have, I think, still today, very little understanding of the epidemiology of this infection, especially gonorrhea and chlamydia, enough to really be able to come with effective interventions that can address these infections. And with the evidence presented by Brian that it's possible that gonorrhea and chlamydia and STIs may have an impact of about 14% of the HIV transmission in our country, and probably even higher among certain populations that may have a higher STD prevalence, high prevalence of rectal infection, gonorrhea and chlamydia, and may have different kind of access to screening and testing programs, I think it's going to be really important to address some of these issues. I think one of the very provocative and very interesting approaches is that what Chris presented in terms of allowing home-based testing, sending, you know, tests at home. We know that from in our population, there is a proportion of men, and men in general, I mean, do not have a relationship with the healthcare system. I mean, men, you know, stop going to the pediatrician when they're 12 years old, don't come back until they need a colonoscopy, and you don't see that many men at 50 raising their hands to have a colonoscopy. So many men, heterosexual men, don't come to the doctors. Women, you know, somehow go to family planning, they go to maternity clinics, they take their children to the pediatricians, and somehow understand a little bit better the healthcare system. So again, if we're going to address the needs of gay, bisexual men, other MSM and transgender women, we have to figure out the way that we can engage them in the screening programs. But one of the very practical issues that is actually missing is the fact that our policies and reimbursement policies with health insurance is actually lagging behind and really do not are not consistent with the clinical guidance recommendations. It is very true that many health insurances will pay only for one test per year. So very often, if you're doing one test per year, which test do you do? That's actually our Ryan White program actually only reimburses for one test per year. So in our clinic, I mean, many of our Ryan White providers will come and say, which test should I do? And no doubt that because the proportion of gonorrhea and chlamydia infection among men who are with men is largely rectal. In most samples that you're going to see, about 80% to 90% of all the gonorrhea and chlamydia infection among men who are with men is rectal. So you can do only one test, it should be the rectal infection. Nevertheless, you will miss some infections for individuals who may be only practicing insertive, you know, anal sex. The question is, I mean, do you believe patients? The guidelines say that people who report only inserted sex should only be tested, you know, in the urethra. And we find in our clinics about 50% of our rectal infectious individuals who do not report any receptive anal sex. So, again, so policy issues that are going to be important. The other thing is that reimbursement is typically only for one test per year, and we're talking about people who actually, guidelines suggest that any person who tests positive for chlamydia gonorrhea should be re-screened at 3 months for reinfection. The other thing is that we recommend more frequent testing every 3 to 6 months to those individuals who are at higher risk of having a recurring infection. So again, very important policy things that are going to have to be addressed if you're going to be able to translate this evidence into effective HIV prevention strategies that are going to have an impact in our population.
And that latter point is really critical too in the era of PrEP, because you know part of the routine care of being prescribed PrEP is routine STI testing. And so even if people are able to negotiate the sort of cost of PrEP through their insurance, often they're not getting insurance coverage for the required STI testing as part of it. So it does require some change in that.
Very correct, yeah. So I want to open for questions, you know, from the audience. Yes.
So the CDC does have a recommendation saying that, you know, you should be getting these rectal STI screenings. And you're saying there's some sort of, I guess, gap in quality of the NAT testing. Is there anything that's being done to address that or improve the testing mechanisms that we can get more people to have on board? Or is it more so providers just aren't comfortable providing the rectal testing for these individuals? I mean, do you have any ideas on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the policy issue is that the lab that the clinic uses has to go through this process of getting approved to do the rectal test with the standard test that's more frequently, you know, that's FDA approved for urine. And so there's some labs who, you know, maybe it's just not a priority for them. They don't, you know, they're not getting those orders coming in enough. There may be some clinicians who don't, you know the process of ordering the rectal test. And so, you know, I've heard things about providers and clinics where, you know, maybe they're the provider who sees a lot more gay men than other providers, and a lot of their the other healthcare providers in the clinic are coming to them and asking for, you know, how do I order that, you know, rectal test again, because they do it so infrequently. So, you know, I think there are some barriers. I would be interested in hearing from people who know more about the aspects of things going through FDA approval, like what is the barrier, why hasn't this happened, who's responsible for advocating for that to happen, because, you know, the reality is in our sample, many of the young men said that they've never received a rectal STI test ever before in their life until they were in our study.
And that's very true, actually. So even, for example, when the test is available through the largest, you know, commercial labs, like LabCorp, you have to request it in your clinic or hospital. And sometimes it takes several months before actually they can get it. And no one ever knows what's the right swab to do. So there's a lot of education, there's a lot of changing of procedures that needs to take place. And then the other barrier is that it requires clinicians to ask people about sexual history and sexual practices. You know, unless they do that, then nothing really happens. There's a question in the back.
Do you capture any adverse events? Can you talk a little bit more about the adverse events of conducting at home STI rectal testing and issues, barriers to conducting these at home? And we also asked about preference, clinic versus at home, and if so, do you see any difference among the racial groups or age groups?
Yeah, I mean, in our study, we have a small number of people who do the test on site at the enrollment process, but the vast majority of participants do it, you know, through themselves and mail it to the CDC for the test to be performed. I know a lot of, you know, even health departments that I've worked with you know, they actually have the patient self-administer the test themselves because it's more preferred by patients than having the clinician administer it. So we haven't had any problems with real adverse events or anything with people self-administering it, like no, you know, anybody injuring themselves or anything in the process. We you know, we have, you know, obviously sometimes we get kits that are returned that are invalid for various reasons, but it's a fairly small, very small rate of invalid results. So I would say it's very acceptable. The participants, you know, find it something that they can do. The way we do it, we don't have the lovely video that our colleagues in New York have.
I should say, please, Daniel, our model, is not an employee of
TED. He's an
you should have seen the auditions for that role. It was a good day.
The way we do it is when the kit arrives, we collect a urine sample and the rectal sample. And so what we have is we have like a placemat kind of thing. They unfold and lay it out on the table, and then they put the cup and the swab, and it sort of explains and walks them through all the steps with illustrations of what to do. And it's very user friendly that way.
I mean, I do think regardless of sort of whether you use a video approach or the placemat kind of approach, you do have to really make the directions explicitly clear, especially if you're doing, you know, both, you know, urethral and rectal testing, and just the number of specimens and what goes where,
yeah,
and all of that. And you know, in our study, as I'm sure in yours, you know, there's a number that they can call that's open, you know, most days and even evening hours if they have questions during the process, because it does require, you know, a fair amount of concentration to be able to make this all happen.
So I have a question for any of you. Is there any reason why you didn't include pharyngeal testing?
Money, I would say both money, but I also am concerned about people shoving a swab down their throat. Gay men are happy to put things up their butt. It's more of an issue putting that thing. The
think
gag
so?
Reflex gets triggered.
You think so?
maybe I'm just disclosing.
That may be you.
Mark. I also think just for us, in terms of using it, in our case, we're using this as a proxy for HIV risk. So for us, looking at rectal...
Which goes back to my earlier comment, because one of the issues that people talk about is actually the role of pharyngeal GC as a reservoir of GC in the epidemic. If you're going to really address this epidemic as a way to control or to reduce the risk of transmission of HIV, you have to, you know, understand the epidemiology of the whole disease.
Yeah.
Mark.
Kristen, I may be something that, and maybe you said this, and I just missed it, maybe that's why I'm subconsciously, that in the CAPSI, did you ask about rectal, did you ask about STD symptoms, and I assume everybody was asymptomatic, or did you not ask?
That's the hindsight vision is 2020. We didn't ask it, and we, you know, probably should have. We are following these participants for 3 years annually, so we have future waves of data collection, and we'll ask for those.
I mean, I guess the presumption would be that if they were symptomatic, they would eventually go seek out care somewhere, so they're much more likely to be asymptomatic, would be my guess.
But we have to have the data on it, which we don't.
Yeah. I think people don't know also. I mean, like, symptoms of rectal STI,
yeah,
you know, it's
a little bit.
There.
Yes.
And how many of those were like new diagnoses versus a positive RTR that had been positive for 20 years?
Right, I think it was 4%.
If you go back to the slide, So where the
4.3 were untreated.
So was the untreated subgroup added to the your outcome? Any STI, or was it all syphilis?
All syphilis.
So some of those could be really concerned.
That is correct.